I keep meeting people who talk about how meaningless and pointless their jobs are. And they'll say, well, you don't really want to know what I do, because to tell you the truth, I don't really do anything. I mean, don't tell my boss. But, you know, and I'd hear this over and over again. And I thought about it, and I thought, you know, this is something nobody talks about. There's millions and millions of people who secretly feel their jobs shouldn't exist.
But are they right?
Well, who would know better than they?
But has a job always historically been meaningless, surely?
Well, most jobs certainly not. Most jobs, I mean, are still meaningful. They do something. But I think what's happened is over the course of the last century or so, mechanization has actually eliminated a lot more jobs than we really think it has. Somehow we have all this technology, but people are actually working more hours rather than less. And this is what I wanted to understand. If you look at it in the 1930s, say, well, you know, almost all those manufacturing jobs have vanished. Almost all the domestic service jobs, the farming jobs have all gone. Yet somehow service, administrative, and clerical jobs have tripled. We have three times as many people pushing paper as we did then,
and
even though we have computers.
Exactly. We've got the computers. And Keynes actually said, as a result of technology, we'd be down to a three-day working week. But he's obviously
wrong. And it's quite possible technologically we could do that if we were still allocating the jobs the way they were in the 1930s. So why have we effectively made up these jobs? When you think about it, there's a whole industries that don't really need to exist. We don't really need telemarketers. We don't really need lobbyists.
Economically, it doesn't make sense to make up jobs. So surely, economically, those jobs are necessary.
Well, this is what fascinates me, right? Because, you know, in theory, this is exactly what shouldn't happen under a competitive capitalist economy. You know, we always used to make fun of the old Soviet Union because they'd make up these jobs because they had an ideal of full employment. Yet, if corporations seem to be doing exactly the same thing, you'd think the last thing they would do is to hire people who don't do anything. But then if you talk to people in the corporation, they say, well, I explained to my boss that my job was unnecessary, and he said, don't tell anybody. I need to have more people under me to be more important. There's all these internal mechanisms. And there's all these people like, you know, I am the East Coast Strategic Vision Manager. And if you talk to these people, if you get them drunk, they'll say, I don't really do anything. I just go to meetings.
But of course, there are plenty of people who do regard themselves as having very important positions, but actually make no impact on society or whatsoever.
Well, you could say. But I'm not here to tell anybody who feels their job is important that they're wrong. I'm here to talk to those people who actually feel their jobs aren't meaningful and are suffering inside.
That's interesting. You say suffering inside. Does that actually mean if my job is not really has any meaning, does that mean I have job dissatisfaction?
Well, I mean, I think I read something by Dostoevsky once when he was in a prison camp, and he said if you want to completely destroy people psychologically, just have them move a rock from one side of the road to the other and then move it back again all day long, or fill pitchers of water, or do something they know is absolutely pointless. Before long, they'll just, you know, it's like the worst torture. They'll do anything to make it stop.
All the traditional justifications for capitalism don't work anymore. They used to say, well, it creates inequality, but even the poor, their kids are going to be better off than they were. Nobody's saying that anymore. It's obviously not true, right? They used to say, well, it creates a larger, ever larger middle class, which will create stability and get rid of war. Yeah, well, that worked. You know, it's going to create massive technological change, so we're all going to be on Mars and Venus, so it won't matter. Well, no, that didn't happen either. So, you know, all the old claims for capitalism don't work. All they've got left is the cultural argument. So they've got us kind of wired to think that, you know, somehow this makes moral sense. It's the only thing that could ever happen. It's the only thing that could ever work. Meanwhile, what you have is this crazy bureaucratization of capitalism, so that, in fact, these bureaucratic classes who are like the most unimaginative people who ever lived, right, are trying to have essentially taken over the engines of capital accumulation. So capital accumulation even happens through bureaucratic means. Not only are the bureaucrats, you know, the minister of class has been absorbed into it, all of capitalism works that way. It's even utopian. It occurred to me the other day, you know, they used to say, ooh, the Soviet Union was, all those experiments are impossible. This is why capitalism is necessary, because anything else is utopian. You're trying to force people into molds in which they will not fit. You know, you try to get people and convince them some ideal of behavior that they won't live up to. And then when you realize they won't live up to the rules and regulations you've created, then you punish them, right? And say, send them off to the gulag for not going along with your ideal. That's why utopianism is bad. Actually, capitalism now works almost exclusively through utopianism of this sort. I'll give you a reason why I think this. JP Morgan Chase, largest bank in America, I think it's the most profitable firm. Anyway, it's up there. 85% of their profits in the last year that I checked came from fees and penalties. Think about that. So basically what they do is they make up a set of rules that they know you can't follow, and then they punish you for not being able to do it right. That's how capitalism now works. Like credit card companies, they set it up. You know, if you actually like balanced your books, they wouldn't make any money, right? It's entirely based on creating rules that imagine an idealized perfect businessman that doesn't actually exist. You know, and telling you that if you don't live up to that, it's your fault. There's something wrong with you, and they're going to take away some of your money. That is the major driving force of capitalism. I would say that is a decaying system, if that's all they've got. And all that they've got now is the cultural logic pinning it up. You know, it's based increasingly on naked force and naked extraction. Because if you're just taking money and fees and penalties, that doesn't work unless you got the army, the bailiffs, the police on your side. It's the state and the capitals are fused together into one engine of extraction held up only by cultural means. And if we can like reverse that, the whole thing will come tumbling down.
Well, that's an interesting point, because some people would just be bored if they didn't have a job. So if you say in an ideal world, if we think our jobs are meaningless, we don't want to go to work, actually a lot of people will be hanging around thinking, I need something to do.
Well, and if you just let people do whatever they wanted, I'm convinced of this, they would probably come up with more meaningful and useful things to do of their time. I mean, nobody would say, I want to be an East Coast strategic vision manager, or, you know, I want to be a human resource consultant. You know, they'd come up with some, maybe they'd write poetry, maybe they would form a band. But ultimately, the benefit to humanity would almost certainly be better than the way we're allocating make work jobs.
Well, there's a benefit of having a job is earning money.
Well, you see, that's the problem. I mean, personally, I'm in favor of a basic income solution. I think that's probably the best idea. I think if we just gave people money, just say, you know, here's £30,000 for everybody, you decide what to do. First of all, you'd have less parasites than you have now. And second of all, you'd have more, people would come up with more interesting things.
I believe that a basic income would work like venture capital for the people. And we can't afford not to do it, because poverty is hugely expensive. Just look at the cost of child poverty in the US, for example. It's estimated at $500 billion each year in terms of higher healthcare spending, higher dropout rates, and more crime. Now, this is an incredible waste of human potential. But let's talk about the elephant in the room. How could we ever afford a basic income guarantee? Well, it's actually a lot cheaper than you may think. What they did in Dauphin is they financed it with a negative income tax. And this means that your income is topped up as soon as you fall below the poverty line. And in that scenario, according to our economist's best estimates, for a net cost of $175 billion, a quarter of US military spending, 1% of GDP, you could lift all impoverished Americans above the poverty line. You could actually eradicate poverty. Now that should be our goal. The time for small thoughts and little nudges is past. I really believe that the time has come for radical new ideas. And basic income is so much more than just another policy. It is also a complete rethink of what work actually is. And in that sense, it will not only free the poor, but also the rest of us. Nowadays, millions of people feel that their jobs have little meaning or significance. A recent poll among 230,000 employees in 142 countries found that only 13% of workers actually like their job. And another poll found that as much as 37% of British workers have a job that they think doesn't even need to exist. It's like Brad Pitt says in Fight Club, too often we're working jobs we hate so we can buy shit we don't need. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm not talking about the teachers and the garbage men and the care workers here. If they'd stop working, we'd be in trouble. You know, I'm talking about all those well-paid professionals with excellent resumes who earn their money during strategic transsector peer-to-peer meetings while brainstorming the value add-on of disruptive co-creation in the network society. Or something like that.
Welcome to English for Managers. Take one, listen, and repeat.
Take one, listen, and repeat.
We will enable timely, knowledge-based decision-making based on real-time information by implementing an enterprise resource management system.
We will entangle timid college-based precision markets based on full-time repudiation by instigating a something, something, whatever.
Very good.
Really? I thought I missed a word. They say they're slow, but they're not.
Repeat. The disconnects between gross margin and leverage will be harnessed for commercial ventures.
The discotheques between gross margarine and beverages will be harmless to your dentures.
Very good. Now close your eyes and visualize each word as you say it. Imagine the word vision. Try to see it in your mind.
Is it black?
Infinity bottles of beer on the wall. Infinity bottles of beer. If one of those bottles should happen to fall, infinity bottles of beer on the wall.
Come on, I can't take another 4 hours of this. Go, go, go!
If one of those
will you just shut up?
Fall,
you have infinite beer on the wall, okay? It will never be fewer.
Now put your hands out to your sides and wave them slowly.
Can you imagine if something were to happen to this bus helmet?
The sciences of physics, chemistry, mathematics, and medicine are wiped out in a stroke.
And economics.
Economics is not a science and never will be.
He's waving us on, finally.
One of the reasons why they posit that it becomes the economy starts to shrink is that people who might have become scientists who in another age dreamt of curing cancer or flying to Mars today dream of becoming hedge fund managers because that's where all the easy money goes as they themselves pour more and more financial products into a specific sector. And they say that, in short, the finance sector lures away high-skilled workers from other industries. The finance sector then lends the money to businesses but tends to favor those firms that have collateral they can pledge against the loan. This actually means builders and property developers. Businessmen are lured into the sector rather than into riskier projects that require high R&D spending and have less collateral to pledge.
Activity in the UK is horrible. That's why the Chancellor and David Cameron decided to include prostitution and drugs into the output or GDP number.
And this is from the World Economic Forum, and they ask, do derivatives make the world safer? And as you can see from this chart, and through the magic of post-production, you're going to see it full screen. Okay? Now, come back to us.
You see, people don't understand that Stacey also directs the show. Not only produces, but as a director as well.
So, the red line, Max.
Yes.
If you look here.
Yeah,
That's GDP growth since 1998. Totally flat. Global GDP. This, however, these top two are the growth of derivatives. The blue line, all derivatives. The green line, interest rate derivatives. So as you can see, the mountain of derivatives, which is nothing but paperwork, the mountain of paperwork has done nothing to increase the economy. And yet they say, all these bankers argue, we need more and more of this paperwork, otherwise the entire economy would collapse. Well, they've had no noticeable impact on the entire economy for all the paperwork they've pushed.
Well, yeah, this is a remarkably clear chart.
What has become of the £375 billion created by the Bank of England under quantitative easing? Have you ever wondered what happened to the £375 billion, equivalent to £6,000 for every man, woman, and child in the United Kingdom, created by the Bank of England electronically? This colossal sum of new money is created through the program called quantitative easing, QE, and pumped into the financial markets by purchasers of government bonds. The campaigning group Positive Money estimates that this money pushed share prices up 20%. The idea was that those benefiting from this would invest this new wealth in the real economy, but the reality is that this new wealth simply went into more financial products to benefit them even more from rising share prices. So this is it. This is the stock market booming. Look, more and more paperwork on top of more and more paperwork on top of more and more paperwork on top of more contracts on top of more paper.
Utopia of rules, technology, stupidity, the secret joys of bureaucracy. Tell us about it.
Well, okay, this book comes from my own realization that we live in one of the, probably the most bureaucratic society that ever existed. Capitalism has created these enormous systems of bureaucracy, but nobody talks about it. I mean, I went to Google Ngrams, you know, where you can see how many times a word is used in all books, and bureaucracy peaks about 1973, and then people just stop talking about it. But then if you put in a word like paperwork, it just goes bam. you know, any of those bureaucratic terms like
red tape.
Additional documentation required. You know, anything like that.
Terms and conditions.
Yeah, exactly. All of those words, it's just like, use more and more and more and more. It's just become the water in which we swim, you know. We don't talk about it because it never occurs to us that life could be any other way.
Now let's talk about healthcare in America for a second, because here in the UK, the cost of administering the healthcare, the bureaucracy, is less than 5% of cost. In America, they want to go over to Obamacare, and they have in a healthcare system where the cost on the admin side, the bureaucracy side, is something like 25%. Is that an example of how bureaucracy kind of eats into the free market?
I don't think it even eats in. I think at this point, the free market and government, or what they call the free market, are so completely fused together that you can't even tell them apart. I mean, like, think of it this way. You're on the phone of your bank. You know, there's something goes wrong. You're trying to spend an hour going through some bureaucratic runaround. Well, you know, where does that come from? You know, is it the bank's a private company? On the other hand, if you talk to the bank, they'll say, there's all these government regulations, you know. But if you look at how they come up with those regulations, well, you know, the bank lobbyists write most of that stuff. You know, and they give money to the politicians and they kind of work it out together. So it's not public, it's not private, it's not market, it's not government, it's both. It's just like this evil synthesis. Okay.